This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of November 5th, here are some top stories.
Nearly 9 in 10 Americans say they know someone who's gay. But for the 1 to 3 million LGBT elders in the U.S., growing old gay could mean going back into the closet. In part one of this three-part series, KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie examines the many hurdles, including stigma, social isolation, and financial challenges that are facing LGBT elders.
I don't think the word homosexual was in the dictionary. It might have been in medical dictionaries, but I don't think Webster's had it.
That video produced by the Boulder County Area Agency on Aging called Project Visibility is used to teach professionals and caregivers in the aging industry how to engage with and support LGBT elders.
And if they are older now, then they have lived in a different environment socially, culturally, than is currently in place today.
Sandy Davenport is with the Pima Council on Aging, and on this day, she and her co-facilitator are painting a picture of what it's like growing up a lesbian born in 1940.
So she's been seen as mentally ill by the American Psychiatric Society for the first 33 years of her life, just for being a lesbian.
Since 2012, the Pima Council on Aging has provided dozens of these free trainings to help highlight the very specific needs of LGBT elders.
And how agencies and facilities can adapt all of their policies and practices and intake forms and lobbies and marketing material and train their staff so that staff are aware of what they should be doing.
That's because many older LGBT adults are afraid of long-term care facilities, according to a study by AARP. The report found more than 60% of LGBT people 45 and older are concerned about being abused or neglected. And 3 out of 4 say they're concerned about having enough support from family and friends as they age. Reverend David Reagan is a senior vice president at Beatitudes Campus, a retirement community in the Valley that's, well, out.
We've gone the extra mile to proclaim that.
By participating in events like the Phoenix Pride Parade, hosting a monthly PFLAG meeting, which is short for Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and advertising in LGBT-friendly publications. Reagan says they do this
because of the huge fear that is out there of coming into a community like ours, because truly, not many are proclaiming that everybody is welcome.
And that means some LGBT elders have to ask. 76-year-old Bill Sabatino has Parkinson's disease. Several months ago, Sabatino and his partner, 68-year-old Dean Taylor, considered moving to an independent living community in Scottsdale.
I dared to ask the question each time, we're a gay couple, is that a problem? No, no, we'd love to have you, we'd love to have you. All three were very accepting us. They wanted us. They've been calling. Some of them are still calling even after we told them we made our decision. We picked it. They still want us. That's pretty embracing.
And that's how it should be, right? Well, that wasn't the case for a married lesbian couple in Missouri who were denied housing in 2016. The reason? According to a lawsuit filed by the couple, the community's cohabitation policy defines marriage as the union of one man and one woman, as marriage is understood in the Bible. And housing is just one of many issues. Here's Dean Taylor.
In terms of family acceptance, the history of people being written off by their family because they were gay, and then now they're at the retirement age, this creates a vulnerability.
That, he says, is not shared by the straight community.
As a group of people, we're keenly aware that it's the best thing to do is to be as financially independent as you can be.
Lori Provost is a 54-year-old LGBT advocate. She was 21 when she came out.
My mom said to me that I was dead and buried and going to hell, and I was not her daughter, and I was not part of this family.
And that rejection continues to have lasting consequences.
Since my dad died, we've had to see the trust documents, and it'll list the other siblings, and this is what's going to happen. And then on every page and every chance she got, she put excluding my daughter, Lori Provost.
Provost and her partner of 13 years joke about creating a commune for aging LGBT people, and they might be onto something. LGBT elders are a growing segment of the population, and many states, including Arizona, have no laws protecting this already vulnerable population from discrimination. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's co-host Lauren Gilger.
The issue of sexual assault on college campuses has become hard to avoid in the news in recent years. And oftentimes, those cases seem to be tied up with student athletes. There's this narrative that college athletes always seem to be the ones whose names are in the news for this. But is it true? How much more likely are athletes to be accused of sexual misconduct or domestic violence? That's the question that Paula Levine and ESPN's Outside the Lines team set out to answer in a nationwide investigation this year. They looked at all 53 public Power 5 schools and the 12 private power schools, but getting that information from universities was another story. Here's Levine via Skype with more.
We sent records requests to all the public Power 5 schools asking them for copies of Title IX complaints in which student athletes had been named as the respondent, because respondent is the term when you're accused in a complaint, of all these particular categories that pertain to sexual assault and domestic violence. And then later down the road, we sent informal requests to the private schools because they're not subject to open records laws, but we still wanted to, you know, try to appeal to their sense of civic duty, transparency, what have you, to see if they might play ball with us. And the initial response was, I think fewer than four schools responded back to the request that the students had sent in saying, okay, here's what we've got. And everybody else said no. And so after that, I went school by school, exchanging emails, talking to public records coordinators, talking to Title IX coordinators, talking to attorneys with the schools, arguing why, look, even if you're not going to give us the actual copies of the complaints, will you do the work to provide us the number? I know the law doesn't require you to do that part, but it would be in the best interest of transparency. And considering how universities are being judged on this issue right now, transparency is a big thing. It would look good for you to be transparent. I tried to make that argument. And it would also be a service to your students, to your faculty, to the athletes. And hey, if you haven't done this before, it's probably going to be a service to you.
Yeah. So overall, what kind of response did you get? How many schools ended up giving you the information you were after here?
So after a tremendous amount of cajoling and emailing and calling and pestering, we went from four schools to 32. And we ended up actually, we had one private school that gave us numbers on student athletes, and that was shockingly Baylor University, which had been under fire for the last several years for its handling of sexual assault complaints involving athletes.
Okay, so let's talk about the findings then. So some of the numbers on from some of these schools, particularly the very large ones, not surprisingly, just seem really, really large. Tell us a little bit about what this looks like.
Well, so the overall finding was that college athletes were about three times more likely than other students to be accused of sexual misconduct or domestic violence, okay? And if you look at the overall average, it was about 6.3% of Title IX complaints against students included an athlete as the person being accused of wrongdoing. And that's a small percentage overall, but when you consider that athletes make up less than 2% of the student body, it's a big overrepresentation.
Yeah.
There were some differences with how schools provided us information. So for example, some schools gave us numbers based upon every single complaint that came in about a student or a student athlete. Other schools had sort of a second step, right? They gave us numbers only in cases where those complaints led to an investigation. Some schools went even further and said, we're going to give you records based upon cases where we've actually charged somebody. And that was the case with Arizona State. They gave us records in which students and athletes were charged with misconduct related to relationship violence or sexual violence, non-consensual sexual contact. And they ended up with, there were a total of 297 of these complaints against students. And of those, seven were against athletes. And that was 2.4%. And then you compare that to 1% of the student body are athletes. So Arizona State's percentage was a little bit lower than the average, obviously, and just slightly more of an overrepresentation.
Right.
And the University of Arizona said they basically declined to do the research here, right?
They provided us the total number of complaints against students, which was 87, but they did not provide the numbers with student athletes.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the schools where you saw the highest numbers.
So Oregon State had 15.8% of the complaints were against athletes, but they were for complaints that resulted in a formal investigation. Baylor was also one of the higher ones. Theirs was 14%. West Virginia was another one, 13.3%. West Virginia is an interesting case because they were one of the very first schools that responded to us and gave us exactly what we asked for. And we went back to them, you know, months later, and we said, hey, you know, this is what your percentage is. It's 13.3%. It's you know, quite a bit higher than how many athletes you have on campus. It's about 2%. And they said, you know, we track this data. They purposefully track this data. But they said, you know, we've never really looked at the discrepancy. So I think it's another good example of even schools that track this information, sort of prompting them to do something with this and see if this calls for a deeper dive.
Yeah. So what kinds of responses, other responses, have you gotten from universities? Have they said, you know, we will track this in the future now that we know, or are they going to make any policy changes based on what they found here?
I hope that comes from not just my correspondence with them, but from the reaction that we're getting from the story. I mean, if you look at the reaction on social media and the emails I've received, there's actually been less reaction from people to the numbers themselves. There's been some, especially with the ones that are higher. There's actually been more of a reaction from people who are saying, you know, why didn't my school provide any data? Like, this is uncalled for. Why didn't you respond to this? I think that's where you're going to see, where I hope we see some change. And I hope it comes from the fans and the alumni and the students and the parents, because they're the ones who should now be asking the question, why isn't my school in here?
Yeah. All right. Paula Levine is an investigative reporter for ESPN. Paula, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Business Desk.
As one of Arizona's founding five C's, citrus production predates statehood. Today, citrus trees still line roadways across the valley, but the industry is stuck. And for one fruit, the market can no longer grow. From KJZZ's business desk, Heather Van Blockland explains how the Arizona lemon is getting squeezed.
Actually, some people who go and will see a tree that isn't being used and will knock on a door and ask if it can be foraged by just seeing things that are going unused and asking permission, which I will stress, ask permission of, as someone whose lemon tree was stripped of lemons while she was on vacation last year.
Pamela Hamilton is publisher and editor of Edible Phoenix magazine.
Just keeping our agricultural land available here in the valley. In the time that I've been here, the amount of farmland that's been paved over and turned into housing developments is astonishing.
She's talking about all farmland, including citrus acreage. Harold Payne is manager of the 2,000-acre Fort McDowell Tribal Farm. Only one-tenth of that is lemon trees.
So lemons are actually they're the most profitable, because a lemon tree will produce three times as much fruit as a navel tree, and the prices are higher. So it doesn't take a lot of math to figure out if you have a choice, you'd be growing lemons.
And people are eating more lemons, used in cooking and flavorings and drinks. Worldwide demand for lemons is at an all-time high. But growers in Arizona are not producing more lemons to meet the rising demand.
The problem is there is no more water. All of the water is allocated that is in the rivers in Arizona. It's actually over-allocated.
Cities and tribes have the highest water priority. Farmers are last in line, which means a smaller lemon crop on limited land with limited water. And prices rise. Add on weather events and natural disasters, and prices fluctuate even more.
And so that's really why you saw the price of lemons rise to very, very high prices towards the end of the summer, was because of the early season and the early harvest of lemon combined with the extreme heat in the latter part of the summer. There just wasn't enough supply to meet the demand.
Harold Edwards is CEO of Limonera, one of the oldest and largest citrus growers in the U.S., once part of Sunkist. His groves in Southern California were damaged this year by hotter temperatures.
And the lemons that were hanging on the tree really had a hard time with that, and the trees had a hard time with that. And so you had a lot of fruit that that was not able to make it through that heat event and fell onto the ground.
And prices rose. In early June, the average price of a lemon box was $36. By July, it was $55. By mid-September, $70.
They tend to be somewhat inelastic from the standpoint of if you go to the grocery store and a lemon costs 30 cents, or you go to that same grocery store and it costs 90 cents, consumers typically buy lemons and don't necessarily let that price differential influence their decision.
There is no alternative for lemons when making things like lemonade or lemon meringue pie. But lemons can get expensive. Part of the problem is there's just not enough citrus grown in Arizona anymore. Glenn Wright is a University of Arizona Extension Specialist for tree fruits.
Well, because of urbanization, primarily in the Phoenix area, and a number of years of poor returns, the industry has shrunk to about 12,000 acres.
But it wasn't always like this.
At one point in the 70s, okay, the Arizona citrus industry, which wasn't just lemons, it included oranges, was about 80,000 acres, quite a lot of it, maybe 40% or so in the Phoenix area, and another 60% in the Yuma area.
Arizona lemons now grow on only 15% of the acreage they once covered in the 70s. Arizona's lemon harvest for 2018 is expected to be its lowest in almost a decade, with production declining to less than half of what it was in 2011. In Phoenix, I'm Heather Van Blockland for KJZZ News.
From the Education Desk, school funding was a hot topic in this election cycle, and early results show some communities did not approve more funding for public school districts. From KJZZ's Education Desk, Casey Kuhn reports.
5 of the 20 school district bonds and overrides in Maricopa County appear to be failing, according to the latest ballot count. Bonds and overrides give school districts a chance to raise more money through local property taxes and bond sales. The Peoria Unified School District's $189 million bond seems to be failing for the second time in a row. Danielle Airy is district spokeswoman.
We know that our staff members are going to continue to serve our students. They're going to continue to do the incredible things that they do in the classroom. They're just going to have to do it now with even fewer resources.
Airy says the first step will be to assess what safety needs schools have to fix with the last of the 2012 bond money, which is $25 million. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein.
The opioid addiction crisis is a reality across the country. It's led to, among other steps, increased regulation, and some hospitals have even reported that they're running out of opioids because of restrictions that have been put in place. It's into this reality that the Food and Drug Administration has stepped with the approval of a new opioid called Dysuvia, which is intended to be used specifically by the Department of Defense. But there are questions, and with me via Skype to answer some of them is Ed Silverman, columnist for PharmaLot and senior writer for Stat News. Ed, is the timing of this FDA approval kind of odd, considering the opioid crisis?
Well, it depends upon one's point of view, of course. The FDA is trying to thread a needle. On one hand, we've got an opioid crisis. Large number, unfortunately, of ongoing opioid overdoses and deaths. And despite all sorts of regulatory and legislative efforts, it's taking a long time to really address the problem, and really we haven't made a dent. On the other hand, in this particular situation, the FDA is saying that it's worked with the military, the Department of Defense, to try to come up with, or at least sign off on, a particular type of delivery system for an opioid that would work well in the battlefield. That was the emphasis, at least, that the FDA made when it explained its decision for the approval that was announced last week. So that is something that is a bit of a twist for the average person, perhaps, who thinks of the opioid crisis and the need for opioids and the challenges in dealing with opioid prescriptions more on a day-to-day civilian basis, really. So this was a distinction. And yes, the company that make this particular product has worked with the military for a while in trying to develop an effective delivery device.
Is Dysuvia truly
10 times stronger than fentanyl? Because there have been a lot of concerns about fentanyl, that if people get addicted to that, that could lead to terrible consequences. In terms of its power, its strength, is it really that strong?
Yes. And so that is a key, as you can imagine, key concern for anyone who worries that the drug will end up in the wrong hands, which we know happens all the time and not just with opioids.
I presume nothing in any aspect of this situation or any other is completely foolproof. How is it that the drug maker can be so certain, or at least coming out and saying they're certain, that this shouldn't be a concern, that this will enter the illegal trade market, that more people will be able to have access to it? Are there, again, coming back to safeguards, are there built-in safeguards that the drug maker is talking about? Or, to some extent, to be cynical, is that pie in the sky?
It's a good question. That's the big debate, because the FDA already has in place for a number of years a so-called risk mitigation strategy. The shorthand acronym is called REMS. But this risk mitigation strategy is typically required of a drug maker at the time of product approval by the FDA, and it often involves, or typically involves, a program that will educate the healthcare providers that administer a drug, monitor the flow of the product, and also provide education or training for the healthcare providers. In this particular case, the FDA is requiring what it calls a medically supervised setting, which means that the drug, DSUVIA, could only be administered by a qualified physician or other healthcare provider who's received the training. And the point there is that it should ideally limit the distribution and access so that it doesn't become available on a black market. The objections, though, that I'm hearing from the critics is that there's no guarantee that won't happen. Medical personnel could, unfortunately, and I'm sure many would take umbrage at this notion, but again, the critics worry that some medical personnel will divert the product, and there it goes, off into the black market or whatever kind of market you want to think of. Is there a guarantee? Unfortunately, no. There's never a guarantee for anything in life. Right. And this is one of those situations where critics say too much is left up in the air. Just because there's a risk mitigation strategy doesn't mean that it will work as intended.
And the FDA commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, had a lengthy statement talking about the decision. What stood out to you about that? And what did you make of it? Is it something that needed to be said based on what we've already talked about, the fear of opioid addiction across the country?
Short answer is yes. I mean, the FDA put itself in a tight spot by agreeing to proceed with this approval. And that's not surprising. It could be anticipated. There was a flap just before the decision was announced. One of the FDA's own advisory panel members, the doctor who chairs the panel, even though he had not been at the actual meeting where the drug was discussed and up for review, he subsequently wrote a letter, made it public, criticizing the FDA for what he felt would likely be the impending approval, and that did happen. And it speaks to, this whole episode does speak to the larger issue that the FDA confronts in trying to get its arms around the opioid problem. And that's really what Gottlieb was trying to address in his statement in announcing the approval the other day. Tried to step back and say, look, we need a drug of this sort in our armamentarium, as he called it. But at the same time, he acknowledged that the FDA, he claims, will not be blind or deaf to the concerns raised by this issue. And where do they go from here? It's going to be very difficult for the FDA to ensure that this risk mitigation strategy can really work. But he's trying to say, effectively, this is not an all or nothing situation. There are some cases where we need something, a product of this sort. And again, some disagree.
Ed Silverman is a columnist for PharmaLot. We've been talking about the FDA's approval of a new opioid called DSUVIA.
And from the Fronteras desk, here's KJZZ's Matthew Casey.
A coalition of people from near Arizona's border with Mexico, the group delivered its message to lawmakers from in front of the state capitol. The group had speakers from Aravaca, Ajo, and the Tohono O'odham Nation, who don't want soldiers in their communities. The border residents also demanded the government protect rights of asylum seekers and reverse what they say has been an ongoing militarization of the region they call home. Amy Wan is from Newfield, which is on the Tohono-O'odham Nation near the border with Mexico. She doesn't believe troops will only be used as support for U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
In light of the president's recent comments, it is clear that the intent behind this deployment is confrontational.
Military officials say there are roughly 1,500 troops in Arizona. More soldiers are still available, but it's unclear if they'll be sent to California, Texas, or Arizona. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.